Fine.
Don't you always want to be the best you can be?
The Frankie Boyer Show.
What is this?
It's more than a lifestyle show.
It's a show about living in today's world.
I think something is happening.
Frankie enthusiastically brings an amazing eclectic mix to the airwaves.
You got that right.
One of the reasons she's earned legions of loyal fans is very simple. When you listen to the Frankie Boyer Show, you just never know what's going to happen next.
So listen for yourself.
Here is Frankie Boyer.
And welcome. It is so nice to have you with us on BizTalk Radio. Well, I have to tell you, the history of the future is a must read for everyone out there. And joining us today is its author, Blake J. Harris. Blake, if you could conceive this 5 years ago, you couldn't even conceive this story. It's such a pleasure. Welcome to the program. You, of course, are the author of the best-selling Console Wars, it's also being. Did I hear that Legendary Entertainment and producer Seth Rogen is producing this for television?
You heard correct. Yeah, my first book, Console Wars, about the behind-the-scenes drama between Sega and Nintendo from the early 90s, is being produced into a TV series by Seth Rogen and Legendary Pictures, and basically a dream come true for me. And this new book, The History of the Future, about Oculus, Facebook, virtual reality. And to your point, Frankie, you know, I would have had no idea that the story would have ended the way it did when I first set out to write it.
First of all, when did you get, what was it about the story that compelled you?
I mean, it really was just the experience, I think, of using Oculus's virtual reality headset. You know, one of the things that interested me was that so many people between 2012 and, say, 2014, right before Oculus sold to Facebook for $3 billion, would try one of these virtual reality headsets and just take it off and say, wow, that's the future. And, you know, we didn't really know what that meant, or especially looking at this from a business standpoint, how to monetize that or how do we move forward. But just that experience was really incredible, and that was certainly a big part of what caught my interest. And then also, reading that book, Ready Player One, which was recently adapted into a movie by Steven Spielberg, that was a big inspiration for me, as well as a lot of the people at Oculus and Facebook who got involved with virtual reality.
So this story is such, I mean, what a story. Tell everybody a little bit of the background, if they're not familiar, of Oculus and how this all unfolded.
Sure. So you know, the book takes a twist towards the end that we can get into or not spoil for your listeners if you want.
No.
But the beginning of it is, yeah, but it just starts off. It's really crazy. To me, it's sort of a modern day American dream story about this 19-year-old kid named Palmer Luckey.
Living in a trailer park, FYI.
Yeah. Living in a trailer, in Long Beach, California. And, the trailer I described in the book, and I think it's one of the things I'm most proud of, it's basically like Walter White's meth van in Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Palmer's trailer has been optimized for virtual reality headsets. And back in 2011, 2012, nobody cared about virtual reality. He was doing this thing that people thought was weird, that was not going to lead to anything. And then through a strange twist of fate, he was contacted by the legendary game maker, John Carmack, who's best known for making games like Doom and Wolfenstein. And then Palmer's journey gets set into motion. And then in less than 2 years, he sells his company to Facebook for almost $3 billion.
Can you imagine?
No, I can't imagine. And one of the most fun parts of this is that Palmer is such an eccentric but grounded person. You know, to him, the best part about making all that money was just that it made it easier for him to do more side projects, like fun stuff with combustion engines and airplanes and stuff that we would never think of. You know, he's a pretty humble guy who really just loves his work. And as a writer, that's fun to write about.
Yeah, I bet. So you started to look at this story. Where are we today with virtual reality?
That's a good question. So, you know, so much of virtual reality, whether it's from science fiction or, you know, the failed attempt at VR in the 90s, is just about this promise, this vision of the future. And with that comes a lot of hype. And so Oculus was the beneficiary of that, and sort of raised this whole industry. Over 2012 to 2014, they released their first consumer VR headset in 2016, as did a company named Valve, who partnered with HTC, and then also Sony PlayStation. So a lot of consumer VR was launched in 2016, and so far, you know, it's been a slow go. I think people are still very bullish about the long-term prospects of virtual reality, but it's just going to take a while to get there. And there's probably, at this point, probably about 5 million headsets out there. But, you know, when Mark Zuckerberg purchased Oculus, and the beginning of the book starts with this, he compared it to the smartphone revolution and was sort of expecting to sell millions and millions and millions of these things within a few years. And that has not been the case, which made for an interesting story, though, as a fan of VR, maybe not a satisfying one.
Yeah, I would think. The truth is that I think virtual reality has a place. And I think that for people that are not mobile, there was years ago when it first hit, when VR was around at the very early, in the early stages, there was some talk about how it could change people's lives and give them experiences that they couldn't get to. And I don't see happening like the promise of that in the early days.
No, I completely agree. I would say, you know, when Facebook acquired Oculus, or I should say Oculus was primarily a gaming company. Their goal was to literally help you step into the game. So with people scratched their heads when Facebook acquired Oculus, you know, you thought if anyone was going to buy them, it would be Microsoft or Sony or Nintendo. But, you know, if you just kind of peel back the surface and see why Facebook, it was because of the social aspect, because of social VR. And to me, that was so much of what you're talking about. You know, I remember telling my grandma that I was working on this book and saying, hey, you know, remember where you went in Italy with grandpa for your honeymoon? You know, you and I could both put on headsets and be in separate apartments in the city and spend, stroll together in Italy. But that hasn't really taken off yet. And I'm surprised by the lack of social VR, given that Facebook is best known for social interactions.
So I have to ask you this, the history of the future, your new book, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality. This book is, what's been the flavor? What have people been feeling? I mean, the book is getting rave reviews, but what are they feeling about the story itself?
That's a good question. I mean, like I sort of alluded to earlier, the story takes a dramatic shift in the final 100 pages and almost becomes a different story. I'm a documentary filmmaker as well, and it definitely feels like one of those stories where what you set out to tell is not what you end up telling. And what happened was in 2016, so it was like 6 or 7 weeks before the presidential election in 2016, there was news reports coming out that claimed that Oculus founder, the kid who had been living in the trailer, who was now 23 years old, that he was responsible for basically running a troll factory and doing a lot of unsavory things in support of Donald Trump, which turned out not to be true. But, you know, as we know in this day and age, if enough people say it, it almost feels like it's true. And it's enough to smear someone's reputation. And then eventually, 6 months after that, he was fired. And what I came to learn was that, you know, that just took me down a whole rabbit hole of political discrimination and other unsavory aspects of Facebook.
Yeah. It also makes you wonder what's going to happen at some point to Facebook, and will Facebook be able to survive all of this? Honestly, I don't know.
I don't know either. And what was very fascinating about, you know, the information that I was able to uncover was that a lot of times with these Facebook scandals or causes of concern, it's sort of faceless. You know, they apologize, and you don't really know who's responsible, or it was a group effort, or someone misunderstood something, or whatever they say. But in this case, you know, one of the climactic moments is Mark Zuckerberg coercing an employee to publicly support a different candidate than he actually was supporting, for fear of perception, because he basically, in Facebook, it was it's almost unacceptable to be a Trump supporter. And so to me, coming from Mark directly, that was a really big deal and really changed my perception of him and the company.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. This is so, the story is, it's just mind blowing. The history of the future. Blake Harris, Blake J. Harris. We've been seeing you on Paul Scheer's How did this get made? Podcast. You've been doing all kinds of fun things and continue to. And this is another home run. And I'm sure they're going to want to do something with this book. The history of the future.
I mentioned my grandmother earlier. And that's, you know, she's very important to me, but it's also important to my writing approach, and perhaps why it lends itself to television and film is I try to write everything I do, whether it's for Paul Scheer's podcast or a 500-page book, to as if it were going to be read by my grandma, and make, you know,
love
it's
it.
A high-tech
love
story,
it.
But it should be read by anyone but VR or don't know anything about VR.
Thank you so much, and we'll be back in just a moment. Frankie Boyer, stay tuned. This is Biz Talk Radio.
Now you can watch business videos on demand. Go to bizvod.com for details. That's bizvod.com.
And welcome back. It is Frankie Boyer. This is Biz Talk Radio, biztalkradio.com. And joining us now is Dr. Keith from ABL Silver, silverbiotics.com. They are the makers of products that enhance our lives. And I have a question for you, Dr. Keith. I know you're getting ready to do a lecture, and you're going to be in Vancouver, and the other team's going to be at the symposium in New York City, and you do this all year round. How many shows do you guys do in a year?
I don't know, probably somewhere between 20 and 30.
How do you, I mean, that's like outrageous. How do you guys deal with that?
We have some really good teams. And different teams we send to different shows.
Yeah.
But it works good. Our guys know their stuff, and it's fun on the market for us because, you know, when people want answers, we actually have them, and we're the only ones.
And so, I can tell you that your booths are the most sought after, and the lines are, like, out there because people are fascinated. But my other question to you is that when you got into this, the mining business, it's family, your family business. If you had a crystal ball, did you ever think you were going to be doing products changing people's lives that were all over internationally acclaimed products all over this world that are making a difference? And was the philosophy do good always part of the company?
I actually never thought we'd be doing what we're doing now. You know, I thought we'd just be producing metal and, you know, selling it to world markets. And where we've been guided to be is way bigger. I mean, it's a lot of fun. What we do now is stuff that nobody's ever been able to do before. You know, in the U.S. congressional testimony, it showed that we could help people with full-blown malaria and that they fully recovered an average of 3.43 days. I never believed that we would be having a dramatic effect with humans in Africa or in Asia, or that we worked with the U.S. military on getting rid of leishmaniasis, which is a parasite that gets in the skin and eats the tissue, or, you know, working with the military to get rid of multi-drug-resistant bugs that were hurting our soldiers, like Acinetobacter baumannii. We did some tests with them showing we killed all 8 multi-drug resistant strains. And so I don't think we ever could have dreamed that we would be doing what we're doing now. But the fun part is we just keep engineering new products that nobody's ever done before. I mean, if you look at it, the approvals we have in Canada on the cream, that's the first ever. The Silver Biotics cream is the first ever antibacterial moisturizer that's 100% organic except for the silver nanoparticle in there. But it helps heal the skin. It does it very quickly. And Canada gave us those first approvals, asking us to include new claims like that. It not only killed bacteria, but it eliminated skin infections. And so you have all these people in Canada now who can use it on stuff like eczema. And we're having a huge effect in like, I don't know, 2 weeks. I mean, when you see some of the pictures I'll show you at the show, it's phenomenal. Some of the great things that we're accomplishing with those products. We've been through 3 rounds with the FDA in the U.S., and I expect we'll win that one, but it may take a while longer on getting the cream approved as an antimicrobial here. But currently, it's available as a just as a cosmetic. Same stuff. It's just available as a cosmetic here. So, but the ability to heal tissue is a huge thing, and we do that really well with both the gel and we do it with the cream. And I think you and I talked about that little girl who severely burnt her hand and used the gel, and she ended up not having to have the skin grafts. All the skin grew back. It was a little two-year-old who touched a hot stove and just severely burnt her hand. And I think it was 28 days and we had helped regrow all the tissue. And it was phenomenal. I mean, it's exciting. It's fun to do what we do and see what we can accomplish.
Absolutely. And the great part about this story is that it continues to expand, because I know that the cream was a spinoff of the gel for silverbiotics.com. And by the way, code Frankie30 gets you 30% off, which is extraordinary. But you also started doing toothpaste, which I'm so grateful for. You have these Manuka lozenges that are spectacular. You have this whole line of skincare now, including the silverbiotics, the healing skin cream, which, by the way, is just amazing. It's a wonderful product. They wonderful products. And now, because of your lovely wife, we now are getting a serum that you're in the process of developing, that you've developed and that you're starting to roll out, that will be available the next time you're on in April.
Yeah, no, I have to tell you, I think the women are just going to be blown away by
that
serum.
Oh, gosh.
The facial
are they
serum
ever?
Is awesome. By the way, I sent you another bottle so you can continue to play with it before it hits the market. But
thank you.
I had them ship a few one the end of last week. But I think what they're going to find is it'll have a natural healing effect on the face, on the skin, and that it will hydrate with the two forms of hyaluronic acid. It'll hydrate and moisturize the skin like nothing else. And I think what they'll find is its ability to naturally help heal the face is going to be really exciting. You put it on, and within 2 minutes, you can actually feel it start to tighten the skin. It is just awesome.
I'm really excited
about that.
And I'm sure that the skincare people are going to be like really pissed off, because you're going to be selling it at a very reasonable and affordable rate. And I want to talk to you about that for just a moment. I can't because we're out of time, but you are absolutely ready to give people product at a very affordable price.
Yeah, we've never tried to gouge people. You can do that, but that's not our mantra. Our mantra is that we do well by doing good, and you don't want to price people out. We really want to be able to help the average.
By the way, we're out of time. It's silverbiotics.com, code Frankie30, or 1-800-605-1541. And we'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned, Frankie Boyer. To make it better. Hey, you. Don't be afraid.
Biz Talk Radio is powered by Freedom Solar. Find out more at freedomsolar.com. Biz Talk Radio.
And welcome back. It's Frankie Boyer, Biz Talk Radio. Joining us now is David Morrow. And David's story is such a great story. He's a certified financial planner and the author of the award-winning The Altitude Journals, a seven-year journey from the lowest point of my life to the highest point on earth. You were the 65th American, congratulations, to complete the seven summits, the highest mountains on each of the seven continents. Wow, 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 wow. Congratulations, David.
Thank you so much, Frankie. It's an honor to be on the show.
So tell us how it all unfolded, because we need to hear stories like this.
Yeah, like most of us, I experienced a very low moment in my life, which included the end of my marriage and the passing of my brother and some other stuff. And I just made a decision that I was going to try and listen to life's instructions in whatever form they came to me and trust them. And it wasn't an easy thing to accept, because I wasn't a mountain climber when the first instruction seemed to be to go climb a mountain. if you're going to commit, you're going to commit. And I did, and I'm so glad I did. That simple decision to say yes changed the entire trajectory of my life and opened up a path of healing and discovery.
Wow. You weren't a mountain. You were not a mountain climber. So
no.
So what made you? When did this journey start to unfold?
When I was 44, and kind of in the throes of this low point that I've described, and I got a birthday present from my younger sister, who lives up in Anchorage, Alaska, and her husband, who at the time was already a well-accomplished mountaineer. And it was a set of climbing poles and a note that said, "Happy birthday, super climber." And I thought, well, what is this about?
Yeah,
I called him up and I said, "Can you explain a little bit about this?" And her husband Ty, he said, "Yeah, we're going to make an attempt on Mount McKinley in 8 months, so now officially renamed Mount Denali, highest point in North America." And he said, "I'd like you to be on the team." And I told him, "Well, I'm honored to be invited, but I'm not a climber, so that sounds like a bad fit. That, from what I understand, is the most dangerous mountain in North America."
Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, "Well, look, we got a team of veterans. We're going to teach you. We're going to look out for you. We'll make sure you don't get into any trouble, but I think you need something like this right about now." And he was so right. And, you know, the funny thing, Frankie, is for most of the time in our lives, we all fear failure. We just do.
Yes, we do.
It's conscious or not. It holds us back in so many things. But the one time you will not fear failure on any level is when you're in the bottom of the barrel. Because what can failure do? Make you feel bad? You're already at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're kind of immune. And I think that just sort of occurred to me. And I thought, well, I don't know what the chances are of actually getting to the top of that mountain, but I think failing can't bother me much at this point, so what the heck? And I committed to going.
How long a trip was it?
About 3 weeks.
Yep. And in that 3 weeks, you had no prior mountain climbing experience. You took on one of the most dangerous mountains. How did you deal with the food, the sleeping, the weather? How did you deal with all of that?
Well, I'll say I dealt with it poorly.
Wait a minute, David. You couldn't have done too poorly, because you're only the 65th person that has climbed seven summits, the highest mountains on each of the seven continents. So I don't know about that.
Well, I got better as time went on, but I arrived, Frankie, at that first climb in the best shape of my life. So I had trained. I took this very seriously. I read every book I could find. I tried to learn, but but I didn't have any true skills and I didn't have any experience. And so
right.
I learned everything by watching my teammates, by listening to them, by trying things, having them not work and finding a better way to try them. The learning curve was about as steep as the mountain on that first climb. And so that's how I came to learn.
So when people listening to this are overwhelmed, we all have problems. We feel stuck.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to people to help them move forward in their lives?
Yeah. Well, I say, first of all, trust life. What you're going through right now will pass, and it's old advice, we've all heard it, but it's also true. There is a better day on the other end of this for you. Truly there is. But in the meantime, the advice I would have is just try and listen to life. And I believe that life is always speaking to us, trying to lead us in the direction that's best for us. But it speaks in this frustratingly tiny voice, and it gets drowned out so easily by traffic and smartphones and cable news and all the other stuff that we miss it most of the time. The way I think many of us come to hear that voice is by going into silence. And for some, that might be prayer, others meditation. For me, it was mountain climbing.
Yeah.
And when you go on a 3-week climb, the mountain just strips away all the BS, the false fronts that you've been telling yourselves, the nonsense narratives that justify staying bitter, all that gets stripped away. And what's left is that tiny voice.
And at the end of it, did you just absolutely love, obviously you must have loved it because you went on to do 6 more mountains.
I did not love it at first. I came back from that first climb, got the profile of the mountain tattooed to my right shin and retired forever from climbing. I was glad I'd done it. I was glad we'd made the summit. I was glad I didn't lose any fingers or toes to frostbite, but it was really, really hard. And
yeah.
I could not for the life of me imagine voluntarily doing that sort of thing again. Life had more to say to me, and that, of course, changed.
So then you decided to – when? I guess my question is, when did you decide to do all 7 summits?
I never did. Yeah, I know. You know, I'm not a great case study on the 7 summits. Most people, you know, they sort of, it's a life ambition, and it's very a linear sort of pursuit of the goal. And I was ready to be done climbing at any time, if another calling did not come, but it always did. And I was always hoping, by the way, my next calling would involve a beach and a piña colada. And
I was going to say, that's more like my calling, yeah.
Yeah, but it was always another mountain, and the one thing I was definitely committed to was listening to the call, trusting what it said, and acting on that instruction. And I'm so very glad I did. Each mountain had something immediately relevant to one of my personal struggles back home to teach me, and I learned to love and to forgive to listen, and somewhere along the way I came to believe in myself again, which is about as far away as you could be from where I was at the start of the story.
So this is such a great inspirational story, and the book is called A 7-Year Journey from the Lowest Point in My Life to the Highest Point on Earth. Do you also climb today for fun?
Yeah, I do. Along the way, I got good at climbing, and it's kind of hard to stop doing something you're good at.
Yeah.
So I don't climb the high-altitude stuff anymore. It's dangerous, and you're going to run out of punches on your card someday. And I kind of put my family through hell for those 7 years I was doing it. So, you know, out of respect and gratitude to them, I've given up the high-altitude stuff. But I'm doing what's called high pointing now, which is a thing in the climbing community. You go to each state and climb the highest thing they have, which in some cases is comically low, But it's a great excuse to see places you might not have, and that's
I love this story. Did your sister ever regret sending you the walking sticks?
Probably, because the story comes full circle when on the last mountain, Mount Everest, when I decide I'm going to go, I call up and I talk Ty, her husband, my brother-in-law, into also going. So I think at that point she had to regret.
Yeah, I'm sure. Thank you so much, David. The book is available. You're all over the country speaking. And what's the best website?
Yeah, davidjmorrow.com. It's got its own Facebook page, The Altitude Journals, and I post lots of fun stuff there, so check it out.
Congratulations. What a great story. If you hit rock bottom, climb back up, and we'll be literally, and we'll be right back. I'm Frankie Boyer, and this is Biz Talk Radio.
This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home for business talk, online at biztalkradio.com.
Welcome back. Frankie Boyer joining me now is Ryan McCormick. Ryan McCormick is a partner in a PR firm, but he has another side to his life, and that is a very, very popular radio show, and it's called The Outer Limits of Inner Truth. And you say it's a program, Ryan, always a pleasure, about introspection, discovery, and evolution.
Right. And Ms. Boyer, it is such an honor to be with you today. Thank you so much for having me on.
So it premiered, happy anniversary, in 2014.
Thank you. Yep.
2014. And it's now, all these years later, it's been picked up for national syndication on Starcom, and it's everywhere
and
now.
It's getting all over the place. It's just shocked at how everything kind of has taken hold. And now we have a core group of people that contribute ideas and put things out there. Like they're kind of, they're pushing it forward. So I'm just, it's beyond humbling. And I can't, I'm so thankful for all your support over the years.
What led you to this conception?
Well, I have always been repressing what I thought was the truth. Since I was a kid, I was always questioning things, but I'd never really spoke out about it. And I think that I repressed that that curiosity for so long until finally exploded in my late 20s, where I basically threw out every idea that I had about every belief system, and I just kind of just went on this journey of seeking teachers. So it's that, it's the curiosity, it's the wanting to know, and to not being afraid of what I will find. It's just it's a curiosity.
Why do you think that we are so afraid of the unknown?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that as human beings, we have this tendency to feel pressure to want to fit in. And if people within our group are saying something different, they'll get ostracized and they'll get out and they'll be pushed out. I think that there's a, that's a fear. It's the fear to be being looked at or perceived to be differently. And I think that's the reason, a big reason why a lot of people don't pursue this. Also, because if you discover a truth that contradicts everything that you believe, it's very unsettling. It'll rock your boat completely. And I think that's why a lot of these belief patterns that we've seen on Earth have remained there for such a long period of time, because people are so afraid of pushing out of their comfort zones.
The topics that you discuss are critical. I know that you did recently Understanding and Healing, a story on suicide.
Sure. Yeah, it's a very tough show. And some of these things, like, I know that one of the things I've actually learned prior to even doing my show is I observed about how when you talk to your guests, you get completely immersed in your guest and you focus on that. So I actually learned that from you. And when I was doing that show on suicide, I actually tried to go into the darkest place possible to understand it possible. So we interviewed people who actually attempted suicide and survived it. And then we also interviewed family members about it. And the reason why I went to certain shows like that so dark is because, you know, talking about something that people don't want to talk about, the hope and the expectation is that people who are looking for that healing can find it. They can find some form of community.
I was just at a funeral on Cape Cod a couple of weeks ago. He was 21 years old, Jack, and it was a suicide. And it was a lot of drugs and trying to get sober and and falling back and then getting sober and going back and forth and back and forth into rehab. And 21 years of age, and he had already been through a lifetime of rehabs and trying all over again. And one of the things that was so, it was just heart-wrenching service. It was beautiful, but heart-wrenching. But what was so great was that everyone shared and talked about him. And I didn't know Jack personally. He was a friend of, I'm a friend of his grandmother's. But it was as though we all knew Jack by the end of the funeral. And one of the things that came out was his uncle spoke, and his uncle shared his own struggle with addiction and his own struggle with suicide and several attempts. And he said, you know, I'm so grateful that none of those attempts worked. And his kids were hysterical crying as he's speaking. And he said, I think for just a brief, fleeting moment, I acted on something, and I'm glad that it didn't work, because I am so grateful for my life today. And he said, and a couple of other people spoke, and the bottom line is that it feels to me that it's suicide can be prevented. We can reach out, we can do a better job in helping people. What do you think about that?
I agree. I think there's a lot that can be done, but it's also a way of understanding it. There are certain topics in our culture that I think people are they don't want to discuss. It's like you don't want to talk. I mean, even that it's a topic, it's something you probably don't want to bring up at a dinner table discussion.
Absolutely.
But the reality is that if you don't talk about it, if you just pretend it's not there, you have a lack of understanding about it. If it does happen, or if you know someone that does happen, you'll be blindsided by it. So I always think that the pursuit of exploration of consciousness is to explore all things positive or negative, because the more of a greater understanding you have about them, I just think that the less you'll be surprised when these things happen, and the more empowered you'll be. I mean, I think if you have this knowledge and information, like you interview a lot of great people on your show, I'm sure you probably learn something from them each and every day.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
Now you have a wealth of knowledge.
Absolutely. Tell me how Robert Kiyosaki fits in onto Outer Limits with his financial.
He did our show twice, and Frankie, one of the things that Mr. Kiyosaki has been talking about, this upcoming financial crisis.
Rich Dad, Poor Dad, by the way. Yep.
Rich Dad, Poor Dad, talking about how we're going to have an actual breakdown of the financial system. And he was very open about it, very determined to talk about it. And he talked about wealth and financial abundance. And he was somebody who's got a really good sense of humor. So sometimes we'll get people on our program that'll be very comfortable, because there's no ideology, so they don't feel like they have to be combative. They can just be who they are. So Mr. Kiyosaki was very open about what his thoughts were about the future, and it's not particularly bright right now, but he did offer a lot of self-empowerment tips. And we've also had Jim Rogers on, who's a legendary investor.
This is great. Congratulations on the show, Ryan McCormick. It's so wonderful that you're doing this. Such great work. Congratulations.
Thank you for all your support.
You're making such a difference. And thank you all. This has been another edition of the Frankie Boyer Show for Biz Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Make it a great day. And as always, smile.
Though your heart is aching, smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through.